going up.
Prices keep going up these days. It feels like being on an elevator that only goes up.
Going up.
But not at Metro. We're pushing the down button.
Going down.
We've lowered prices and give you a 5-year price guarantee on talk, text, and data. Get one line of 5G data for $40, period. That's 20% lower. Only at Metro.
5-year guarantee on eligible plans. Exclusions apply. See website for details. Not available at Metro with T-Mobile in the past 6 months. Tax applies.
This episode is brought to you by Progressive Insurance. What if comparing car insurance rates was as easy as putting on your favorite podcast? With Progressive, it is. Just visit the Progressive website to quote with all the coverages you want. You'll see Progressive's direct rate, then their tool will provide options from other companies so you can compare. All you need to do is choose the rate and coverage you like. Quote today at Progressive.com to join the over 28 million drivers who trust Progressive. Progressive Casualty Insurance Company and Affiliates. Comparison rates not available in all states or situations. Prices vary based on how you buy.
Today's episode is sponsored by NerdWallet's Smart Money Podcast. Making financial decisions shouldn't feel like picking a TV show. Too many options, too much hype, and no way to know what's actually good. NerdWallet's Smart Money Podcast cuts through the clutter. Their finance journalists break through real-world money decisions with clear, research-backed insights. From investing to home buying to credit cards, the nerds help you navigate major financial decisions with confidence. Leave TV to fate. Leave your next financial move to the nerds. Follow NerdWallet's Smart Money Podcast wherever you listen.
Well, I think if I had a crystal ball, I would answer that question. I think that we have 11 picks. I've always looked at draft picks as currency. You can either use that on a player, you can trade up, you can trade back, you can trade for future picks in future years. I think we're fortunate to be in this position. I think that as we continue to sign back our players, as many as we can, our good young players, we're going to be in a situation where, you know, salary cap is critical. And so for us, young talent, the influx of young players every single year, competing to make the roster, I think is really important. Now, we have a good team. We feel good about our roster. It's going to be hard for 11 players to make the team out of the gates this year. I mean, if they do, it'd be incredible. History tells us that probably not all 11 picks are going to make the initial 53-man roster, which is a good problem to have. It means we're a talented team. So I like having 11 picks. I think it gives us a lot of flexibility in different ways. And I think that our goal would be to have extra picks every single year.
Give EDC all of the picks. The Ravens have 11 picks. That is tied for the most in this year's NFL draft. No Ken Wyman with us because he's doing draft duties with Vinny.
He's doing voice exercises right now, I think. He's getting his voice all limbered up for the draft.
You always get a kick out of it. And if Kenny was here, he would say this. It's hard to believe that the draft is today, Jason.
And it's not hard to believe at all. Yeah. First of all, they should do this in February, honestly.
This is just prolonging the
NFL calendar. They drag it out. So they drag out the news cycle and they keep people talking about it and they keep us bloviating about it.
Why do you think they pushed back the schedule release? It used to always be before the draft. Now it's in May. Yeah.
They want to dominate the full calendar year. I get it. But I can believe it's here. Thank God it's here, and I can't wait for it to be over. I'm speaking my truth.
You put out your one and only mock draft for the Washington Post.
Did.
We will get into that at 3:15. But focusing in on the Ravens, and we just heard Eric DaCosta. That was at the Liars Luncheon last week.
He's speaking his truth, and that's I think he's keeping it real.
And we were talking about this possibility a week ago. Could Eric DaCosta break tendency tonight? And just looking, he's been GM since 2019. This is his seventh draft as GM of the Ravens. The highest round that he has traded up was the third round in his first draft to get Miles Boykin. Now, he had the players trade for Marquise Brown to the Cardinals for a first-round pick, but we have not seen him move up in the first round pick for pick. Could he have a trick up his sleeve tonight?
I don't think so, Bone. And I'm not buying a lot of this late chatter about trades. I mean, people talk this time of year. The boards are set. There's a pretty decent consensus, at least on the top five picks and where they're going. And people are comparing notes and people are setting up for contingencies. But I just don't see this as being the kind of class overflowing with blue chip players that people really want to start jerry-rigging the board and moving around to land. So I don't think they're going to be super inclined to move up. I think, if anything, moving down, and I know that that just, we could say that every year, but I think with them, especially with a draft like this, and them always thinking towards the future, and we move down and we get picks loading up day two and also start fortifying our cupboard for the 2026 draft. It's just very on brand, and I think the depth and the strength of this draft meeting their needs might make them even more inclined to do that. If they're the team that trades out of the first round because somebody's moving up for Jalen Milroe or Jackson Dart or whatever, it wouldn't surprise me. Them moving up eight spots to get a particular pass rusher in this draft would surprise me far more than them trading out. I think it's probably more likely that one of these other rounds where they're already loaded with picks, that maybe they start packaging, I don't know, what do they have, three fourth rounders or whatever. You know, they try to get an extra pick at the end of Friday, right? You kind of have these cutoff points where you'd rather get something at the end of Friday than have somebody else all day Friday night make a trade that jumps you on Saturday. So, yeah, I think they will probably stick to their core tenets. I think if they do make a pick there, it's more likely to be defense than not. And I think their hallmarks, they feel like, are tried and true.
That was going to be my next question. The Ravens have a pick in every single round. They have 2 fourth-round picks, 4 sixth-round picks, Jason. Are they going to use all 4 sixth-round picks? But assuming they stand pat at 27, we've talked so much in the lead-up to tonight. Well, it's got to be defense. And maybe if it's not defense, we talked a lot of offensive line this week. If it wasn't one of those two options, would that surprise you? We know Eric DaCosta loves swinging at wide receivers. Maybe a tight end falls, and that necessitates a Mark Andrews trade. If they went outside of defense or O-line tonight, would you be surprised?
I would, and I think the one position that might make sense would be receiver. I don't think there's going to be a tight end. I think both tight ends are gone by the time the Colts pick, so they're going to be long gone, and I don't think there's a third tight end that you're going to take in the first round. There could be a running back there who they have a really high grade on. I just think for them at this point and that position group, it wouldn't make as much sense as probably a receiver. And the kid from Ohio State is the one that if I had to throw a dart at, I would throw a dart in his direction. And it's hard. It's hard for me to come up with another position just based on, you know, the quality of player, who's likely to be there, and then what they want to do. I really can't come up with something outside of defense, offensive line, except for wide receiver.
We're on till 5:30. That's when BBT with yours truly and Jim Hunter takes over. Then you got the Fresh Take with Ben and Cordell. Then you have Ken Wyman and Vinny Serrato, 8 to midnight. We're live till midnight, Jason. No infinity today for the people.
I can't wait till it's like pick 16. And Gigi's like, I can't believe pick 16 is actually here. Yeah, I can't believe it. We've made it to pick 16. It crept up on me. Two and a half hours in. We're at pick 16. Well, yeah. It's 8:08 in the a.m. I got it.
We don't have many guests today. We have a lot of Ravens draft talk as well as Orioles talk, where they lost another game last night. But Sagano pitched really well, rebounded really well after that first inning. But Tony Gwynn Jr., Odyssey MLB insider, joins us at 2:30, and Lucy Burge joins us at 4.
Yeah, don't worry, O's fans. We haven't forgotten about last night's debacle. And if you're not familiar with tonight's starter for the Nats, Mackenzie Gore is probably in this very moment the best left-handed pitcher in baseball. Now, I know I said over the weekend that Hunter Green's looking like the best right-handed pitcher in baseball, and he got lit up. But again, this guy's a lefty, and if you've been scoring at home, you know that they can't get runners to second base against lefties, let alone score runs on them. And Mackenzie Gore is a strikeout machine with a legitimate, you know, 3-4 pitch mix who seems to have really come into his own. And also Cade Povich has like a career 9 ERA on the road.
I'm grasping at straws, but Mackenzie Gore does have reverse splits, Jason.
And we'll see what the lineup says and how they embrace that.
We will. Coming up next, we're going to keep...
Seti might hit him. I don't know about anybody else.
Oh, Seti hits any lefty.
Seti's a machine.
Yes, he is. Coming up next, we're going to keep the draft talk rolling. What are a handful of draft prospects that make the most sense for the Ravens at pick 27? We'll tell you next on The Fan.
Every morning brings a fresh new energy.
This is Today.
And no matter what the day holds, we come to the Today Show for all of it.
When things are tough, we talk about it. When there's something to figure out, we dig into it. And when there's joy, we celebrate it.
Because today is where it's all happening. We get the best start to every morning because we start it together.
Watch the Today Show with Savannah Guthrie and Craig Melvin weekdays at 7 a.m. on NBC.
It was good. It was real good. They love ball and I love ball, so I'm blessed.
Truly a blessing because I feel like that's the best D tackle in the game right now. How quickly he is to grab wrists and elbows, I feel like that comes natural to me. So I feel like our game really shows each other like that. So yes, man.
Yeah, you're gonna go and people are gonna say, oh yeah, this is this type of injury. You just can't listen to any of that. You just have to go in rehab and just kill it every day. Be mad at every single rep in rehab, just knowing that. Get your mindset to be ready to be back to the person that you were before.
That was Malachi Starks, Derek Harmon, and Josh Simmons. Maybe one of those three could be the Ravens' pick at 27. And we know this team's needs on the defensive side of the ball, and we've been talking about edge rush for years now, and they've racked up sacks over the past couple of years, but more consistent pressure is needed. Eric DaCosta talked about the edge group.
Well, I do think it's a good draft class. Now, if I'm not mistaken, we've got our entire outside linebacker core coming back this year. So that's a great situation for us because we didn't lose anybody. And so from that standpoint, I think it's good. Now, again, there are some really talented guys in this draft class. And, you know, there are guys that we'll be looking at as first-round guys, second-round guys, third-round guys, fourth-round guys we think could come in and compete to really play right away or develop and become really good players. So that's exciting for us. I think that if you're looking at the offensive line, the defensive line, and the, you know, outside linebackers as a whole, I would say that three are the strongest positions in this draft class.
Those three position groups, all needs for Eric DaCosta and the Ravens, in addition to safety, Jason. But who are some specific names you're going to keep an eye on tonight?
Yeah, I mean, look. There's differing opinions. A kid like Walter Nolan, the versatile D tackle from Ole Miss, I think he's got potential to go in the top 12, 13 picks of the draft. Daniel Jeremiah doesn't have him going in the first round of his draft. Daniel Jeremiah not only doesn't have him going in the first round of the draft, but has the Ravens taking a D tackle, but a different one, Kenneth Grant, who doesn't have nearly the position flexibility or pass rush potential to Walter Nolan over him. Now, I bring that up because Daniel Jeremiah used to work for the Ravens. Daniel Jeremiah talks to people with the Ravens. Not to say he always knows the Ravens pick, but I found that dynamic interesting because it runs counter to the GMs and the scouts and the evaluators that I've talked to about this class vis-a-vis the Ravens and the entire draft board. And those guys think a guy like Walter Nolan would be a slam dunk for the Ravens, but they don't think there's any chance Walter Nolan's there.
I did find that very interesting as well, and I think that Grant could factor into my six-pack that we're going to do, six most likely guys that the Ravens could take at pick 27 in the 5 o'clock hour, because Daniel Jeremiah, like you said, Jason, he worked for the Ravens. He worked with Eric DaCosta, and he actually had the Ravens taking Nate Wiggins in his mock draft last year.
Yeah, and there are years where people get sort of used or they get asked to do a favor and could you put that guy with us because everybody thinks you know our pick and, you know, no one's going to get 32 out of 32 sure. Anyway. It's not really how Daniel Jeremiah is graded at the end of the day either, but it is a dynamic worth noting. I think that the D-tackles with pass rush potential will be picked through well before the Ravens are on the board. And for me, if it was Kenneth Grant versus some of the corners who might be available, I would think they might lean corner. Like, I'm not totally convinced that Will Johnson won't still be on the board. A lot of people would say they think Will Johnson out of Michigan, obviously a program that this organization knows very well, is the top corner in this draft outside of Travis Hunter. I don't think it's out of the question that he's there. I think Jahdi Barron could very well be there. That's another kid. I a lot of GMs I talk to don't think that kid should go in the first round. Doesn't mean that somebody won't think he could. Could one or both of the safeties be there? I don't think they'll both be there. One of them probably is. Is Amanwori too much like Kyle Hamilton? I don't know. Obviously, Starks has a little different body type, has a little different skill set, might be even more position flexible. I don't think, all things being equal, they would find many guys more interesting to them than Malachi Starks, but they might. From a pass rush perspective, I'm sure there'll be a guy or two there worth consideration. I don't think Shamar Stewart will be one of them. I think he's going to go pretty high. I think both the Georgia pass rushers will be gone before the Ravens pick. The kid, Azaraku, at a Boston College, like, I think he might be there. And they might have their choice of him and Starks and an offensive lineman. Now, will that offensive lineman be totally healthy right now, or will that offensive lineman be someone like the young man Simmons, who's probably going to need to redshirt at least part of the year? And this, you know, this kid from North Dakota, Gray Zabel, who's sort of a plug-and-play interior offensive lineman, some people don't have him going in the first round at all. Some people have him going in the high teens. He may make sense for them.
I was going to bring up another interior guy, and we know Ozzie Newsome's affinity for Alabama. Tyler Booker, is that a possibility?
I don't think he'll be there, but yeah, if he's there, that's some. I don't know how somebody like him, frankly, would get past Houston and Minnesota. But I also don't know how the board's going to look when they pick and where the value's going to be. I'd be surprised if he's there. If he's there, I absolutely think he would be under strong consideration.
Does it seem like, and you could probably say this every single year with the draft, but there's so many varying opinions this year about where guys could go and where, like, and we see the odds reflected in that in the various sports books. They're, you look 6 hours from now, this guy's over under is 20, and then it's 17, and it seems like it's a little all over the place right now.
I think even who are the 6th through 15th best player in this draft, I don't think there's a whole lot of consensus there. I think it's, you know, a lot of times, my experience, I've been doing this a long time, you usually could get, in a lot of years, I feel like 13, 14, 15 in. Some years I might even say 17, 18 in, and I'm like, I'm really comfortable that all those kids are at least going in the top 25. You know what I mean? Like, I feel like there's a really good sense of 18 to 20 out of the first 20 to 20, you know, first 25 to 28 picks. I don't have that sense. I ask other people, does this seem different to you in that way too? People who do this for a living, who are decision makers for NFL teams. And they say, yeah, that, like, there just aren't as many true blue chip players who absolutely are best of breed at all these different influential position groups. And then things kind of fall on the line after that. The quarterback variable, where they're not super special by and large, but there's so much quarterback need. And next year's class doesn't look great. And this year's free agency class sucked. And next year's free agency class is going to suck. Like, that's a factor that's going to pull some people in a way that 6 weeks ago they might not have thought they were going to go. And all that, there's obviously a trickle-down effect to all of this. There's also a lot of first-time people, like, totally new, not just a first-time head coach, but in many cases a first-time coach with a first-time GM. So there's no body of work, right? There's no real history. Or a guy like Vrabel, who he didn't get to pick the groceries in Tennessee. Like, we can look at what Tennessee did when he was there, but he was always clashing with the GMs because, frankly, he was better than the GMs, right? But now he's in New England. He's got the jam. I mean, he's going to be heavily involved in the draft. So it's trying to sort of interpret those situations and what you think people are going to do who, frankly, don't have a body of work at this particular nuance of drafting.
Well, looking at just the prospects, because basically what you were saying is kind of what Eric DaCosta was saying at the draft luncheon last week when he was asked about, it's more of the depth this year. It's more of the middle round.
Yes.
And he compared it to 2022 when the Ravens had 6 fourth round picks. Is that what you're hearing, where DaCosta, what do you have, 217 draftable players or some number around that, where maybe it's not top heavy at all, but the meat of this draft is the middle rounds?
I mean, that seems cliched, and maybe we do hear that a lot of years, but I think that is absolutely the sort of, that's the gravitational force of this draft. And like, people are going to be pulled to that, right? People are going to be pulled to, do I need to do this now? Because I still think there's going to be a bunch of dudes in the third round who are pretty similar to this player who we could coach up to be that player. And in the meantime, we address this. And there's going to be other people who just say, no, that's fool's gold. I'm going to keep, you know, I'm going to keep taking the best player that I see at D-tackle. And I don't care that you think there's a similar guy who's going to go 25 picks down the road. I think it will affect different people different ways. And frankly, a lot of that will depend on what is their depth chart at that D-tackle look like right now.
In about 20 minutes, we're going to get into Tomoyuki Sugano's start last night. First inning, the rest of the way, really, really good for Sugano. We'll get into that at 2:45. But coming up next, Tony Gwynn Jr., what the heck is going on with this Orioles offense? Can they right the ship? We'll also go around MLB as well. Mets, they've won 7 straight games. We'll get Tony's thoughts on that next. We are efforting to get Tony Gwynn Jr., our MLB Odyssey insider. But until then, Jason, Tomoyuki Sugano, when the game started yesterday, it took Dean Kramer, 6 pitches to be down 2-0. It was 5 pitches before James Wood hit an exit velocity of 116.3 off Sugano. Then he gave up another homer, and it was 3-0. And I'm thinking, oh my gosh, here we go again. But from that point on, Sugano was able to settle in, and there really wasn't a ton of hard contact after that. He gave up 4 hard hit balls, and hard hit balls are considered 95 miles per hour. 4 in the first inning, 4 the rest of the way. But we do have Tony Gwynn Jr. on hold right now, our Odyssey MLB insider. And Tony is brought to us by Grainger. With supplies and solutions for every industry, Grainger has the right product for you. Call clickgrainger.com or just stop by. And Tony, Orioles offense. We knew that this offense was going to have to outscore the opposition, because even heading into the year, and it's probably been worse than we thought, the starting rotation did not look good on paper. But we've seen this offense be inconsistent at best going back to last June. What is off about this group to you?
They have all of a sudden, really seemingly all at the same time, like, had big time struggles. You know, I don't think anybody could see Gunner where he's at right now. I mean, this dude has been a dude since he's arrived in the league, and he's struggling a little bit. Rutschman struggling a little bit. And listen, when you have those two guys in particular, at least in my opinion, have always kind of been in the mix in terms of making that Orioles offense go. When they're not going, it's going to look different. And then you add that to what you were talking about, you know, in the lead into this, which is starting pitching, it wasn't really addressed. And so you kind of have the world's kind of crashing at the same time. And, you know, when you're this early, it's hard not to kind of feel a sense of panic. But I still believe that these guys are going to rise to their normal norms at some point this year.
You've been around the game for a long time. You've seen a lot of things. And I know we're not that far removed from this team winning 100 games in a season, but you also go back over their last 100 games to July of last year, and they're 10 games below 500. They're going to lose this series to the Nats, and with Mackenzie Gore on the mound today, they may get swept. Then they go to Detroit, and then they come home for 3 against the Yankees. If they can't win more than one of these games in that stretch, they have an off day next Thursday. I'm wondering if that's Brandon Hyde's last day on the job. Am I crazy?
You know, you'd ask me that a few years ago, I'd have been like, you're crazy.
Yeah.
But given the times that we are in, and it's not just in baseball, really with coaches, managers across all sports, there's an urgency that I think in today's day is, in my opinion, too quick, but it is the reality that we're living in right now. And yeah, public pressure, the fact that they haven't played that well over going back to last year, it certainly starts to put that into question. And when you have as talented of an offense that the Orioles have, people are going to start to look for answers, and I wouldn't be surprised. I don't think it should happen, right. But I wouldn't be surprised if that was the route that, you know, at least starts to come into focus.
Tony, I'm certainly not going to blame the Orioles' loss last night on C.B. Buckner, but he was horrendous. He has been horrendous for years now. And this is more of an MLB issue. Just how shocked are you, surprised, maybe not at all, that the ABS challenge system is not in the majors and has been in the minors for years?
That's an interesting question. I think I'm not shocked because they've been trying to get that system to be perfect for a while. And I think what they've come to the realization is it may be too tough to do it. And so the ABS system in the way we saw it in spring training is probably the answer moving forward. Mm-hmm. I think initially, I don't know that they intended for it to be kind of, you know, brought up the way we saw it during spring training. I think it was intended initially to just be the system overall, but I think they realized that it was going to be a little bit tougher climb. And so I think they just want to make sure it's right. I think they laid it out perfectly, I think, this year, giving the players a chance to kind of get used to it, get their feet wet with it a little bit. And, you know, all in all, I think the players kind of adapted to it, and some enjoyed it, some didn't. I think from my perspective, what it made me realize is that, you know, put the C.B. Buckners aside for a second. Those umpires are really good. Most of the ones that were challenged during spring training, we're talking less than an inch a lot of times. And, you know, I expect that from the human side. So I think it'll be here next year. And, you know, I think it'll kind of quiet a lot of the conversation, at least for the time being. Eventually, we'll get to a point where we're focused on the amount of misses an umpire has as we get going into that system in the coming years.
Tony, I mentioned the Orioles' last 100 games. We can go, I don't know, about an hour and 10 minutes up the road here on 95 to Philadelphia and go back to the Orioles playing the Phillies in a series last July and people talking about it as a potential World Series preview. Since then, Aaron Nola's become about as hittable as any pitcher in the league. The Phillies' bullpen has gone from a weakness to a strength back to seemingly a weakness. They're right below 500 when they've played good teams this year like the Mets. They've really struggled. What's going on there?
You know, the Phillies are interesting because, as you alluded to, they've been here before, especially with their bullpen. It wasn't that long ago where their bullpen wasn't worth anything, and then all of a sudden they all started throwing ball well, and now they kind of reverted. And I don't know that I necessarily am panicked about that. I think bullpen arms in general are the most volatile. Mm. It's the most volatile position in baseball. From year to year, you kind of, with the exception of a few guys, you really don't know what you're going to get year in and year out. And so this may be the year. And you give the Phillies credit. They've stuck with those guys a lot of times, even when it seemed like they shouldn't. This may be the year they got to kind of flip them out and get some new blood in there, because you know, they have, as you said, regressed from that standpoint. Offensively, you know, it's tough for me to worry about that team offensively. They got some dudes that just know how to play baseball and they know how to win. And so I think that'll keep them afloat, but they're going to have to get to the bullpen issue. And Nola's a bit of a concern too, right?
Yeah.
I mean, kind of seen, I think his stuff kind of come back a little bit. It's kind of regressed a little bit. And now all of a sudden he's getting hit over the yard. I think, as I said earlier, I think cream does rise to the top most of the time. I think he'll get back to close to where he was. But certainly right now you got to be a little bit concerned if you're the Phillies, especially with that bullpen. That's the main issue to me.
Tony, you're, of course, part of the Padres radio network, and the Padres just lost 4 of 6 on their road trip, but they return home to San Diego beginning tomorrow.
Slam Diego. That's Slam Diego.
And they've been dominant there, 12-1 at home, and it seems like there's just a heck of an environment at that ballpark right now. How much of a factor is that environment for this club?
It's a factor, but the interesting thing is I think the visiting teams enjoy the environment just as much as the home team does. I mean, you hear it consistently now when teams come into town how much they enjoy that environment. I don't know that it's as hostile as maybe a Philly or Chicago, but it's a party. It really is. And I think more importantly, the Padres, I think they feed off of it. There's just a different type of energy that they have when they played at home to start the season than they have on the road. Now, that being said, we just saw the Detroit Tigers. That's a good baseball team.
Yeah.
Houston Astros played a lot better than their record said they were. And so, you know, I think that has played a part in some of their road woes. They played the Cubs earlier, who were playing great baseball. But certainly at home, they have, you know, you look at the splits. I know it's really too early to be looking at that kind of stuff, but they're a completely different team at home than they've been on the road this year.
He's all to see MLB insider Tony Gwynn Jr. with supplies and solutions for every industry. Grainger has the right product for you. Call clickgrainger.com or just stop by. Tony, thanks so much as always.
Thank you.
We'll talk next week.
All right. Thanks, guys.
We asked Tony about the Orioles lineup that was allergic to coming through with runners in scoring position last night. We're going to get into that offense at the top of the hour, but coming up next, we're going to get back into Tomoyuki Sugano's start last night, really settled in after that first inning. That's next on The Fan.
You know, he hung that one to Bell there in the first, but I thought he mixed really well after that. Didn't show any sign of that he was getting tired or just knows how to pitch, and really, really did a great job of mixing speeds and keeping them off balance for seven innings.
That was Brandon Hyde following last night's 4-3 loss to the Nationals. There was a lot bad with the Orioles offense that we're going to get to in about 10 minutes, but a lot of good from Tomo Sugano, again, completing seven innings, back-to-back starts. He was getting hammered in the first inning, like Hyder was saying, the Josh Bell homer. He gave up four hard-hit balls in the first inning. He gave up four hard-hit balls in his final six innings, Jason, and he retired 19 of his next 21 batters after that first inning.
Yeah, we're going to lead with the good here, but don't worry. We will be eviscerating these guys in the next segment, including coming in with some of the pablum that Brandon Hyde was spewing last night about moral victories. Get that out of here. I tried to tell you guys before this series started that James Wood is one of the baddest mamba jammas in Major League Baseball right now. He is an aircraft carrier. He is a freight train, and he will destroy you out of the leadoff spot if you let him. 431. What did I say? This dude hits 430-foot bombs the other way and doesn't flinch.
116 off the bat.
Yeah. You can't let him beat you. Unfortunately, he beat him first, you know, plate appearance of the game. Sugano battled, I think, is the perfect way to put it. And they'll take their positives where they get them. And he kept them in that game, and frankly, I thought he was going to shatter in the second inning, and he didn't, and he got better. Now, I will also, being the analyst that I am, point out, you mentioned all those fours, four hard-hit balls right off the bat. He also got four swing and miss all night. Like, Jackson Rutledge comes out of the other team's bullpen, gets four swing and miss on these mooks in an inning. This guy only got four swing and miss, so like... He's facing a lineup that's very sort of young and naive, not very deep. And so I'm just going to tell you, when we get into the AL East of it all, that I don't think that stuff's going to fly. I think it's going to fly against Boston. I don't think it's going to fly against New York. I don't think it's going to fly against Texas, even though Texas isn't hitting the ball right now. I don't think it's going to fly against the Astros. But against some of the lineups that he's faced, the lesser lineups, he's been able to battle and stop the bleeding at a certain point and lean on his rich reservoir of multiple pitches and gut his way through it. But you're not going to find many major league pitchers who go seven innings against that lineup and only get four swing and miss.
Well, we're going to find out next week because his next start is going to come against the Yankees.
In Yankee Stadium. Or here, in Camden Yards.
But that was the one spring training game that he struggled.
It was bad. It was Jazz Chisholm. It was Anthony Dominguez.
Jason Dominguez.
It was Bellinger, who's not hitting anything right now. So, yeah. But look, he did what they more than – well, I shouldn't say more than. He gave them what the best they could have hoped for.
Absolutely.
I still think he's going to give up a lot of hard contact. I still think the best hitters in baseball are going to have their way with him. And hopefully when that happens, it's solo shots. And, you know, he also – got his command in check and wasn't giving out a bunch of free passes. And that's been my biggest issue with him is you sold him as Greg Maddux type control and command. He needs to have that. Again, he will absolutely need to have that against the Yankees next week.
Back-to-back starts with zero walks, and now he's in the 87th percentile on walk rate.
Yeah, I mean, and I think he's going to have to be in the 90-something percentile for the season for him to end up giving them the kind of innings and the kind of impact that they would have hoped for. But I think composure-wise and sort of like just the look of it, like, frankly, I thought this guy crumbled a couple times on the mound already this year, and he didn't here. Now, again, that's a big ballpark, and that's a not very good lineup. So,
I'm not
drawing major conclusions from it.
But here's the issue, and we were talking prior to the show. If he was, and if Mike Elias did construct this starting rotation in the right way, and this guy was a 4 or 5,
different story.
This you're fine with this. You're okay. Like back to back set. He's had the Orioles' two best starts this season. And that's telling of where this starting rotation's at.
Yeah, look, I've got a lot of issues with this baseball team right now. Sagano is not high on that list whatsoever.
Well, one of the guys that you had an issue with is who followed Sagano, and that was Gregory Soto. And it needs to be pointed out that how C.B. Buckner did not ring up James Wood, it was a joke. And Kevin Brown,
that wasn't even a high strike. Yeah. It was just a strike. Like it wasn't borderline high strike. Yeah. It was at the dude's nipples. It was a strike.
Yeah. Kevin Brown said it. You know, it was a ball right down the middle. And Wood ended up walking to make it first and second, nobody out. Garcia, a couple batters later, ended up hitting the sack fly, and that ended up being the game-winning run for the Nats. But you look at Gregory Soto's last four outings now, 2 2/3 innings, 6 hits, 4 runs, 3 walks, 1 K.
He is a middling lefty-lefty specialist. He's not even a good lefty-lefty specialist because his control sucks. He's a middling lefty-lefty specialist who the Phillies, whose bullpen is garbage right now, wouldn't let pitch the sixth inning. He was a fifth inning mop-up guy. And you can sit here like Gigi did and try to, you know, sell me on flowers and buttercups and what he did in the Grapefruit League and what he did the first couple times out against bad lineups, the back end against bad lineups in low leverage situations. And I said, keep running him out there in the eighth inning. Let him pitch in high leverage situations, you idiots in the warehouse. And I dare you let him face righties and lefties in the middle of lineups in high leverage situations so he can poop his pants on television again. He's pooping his pants on television again.
Double dared
just
him.
Just like I told you he would. So keep doing it.
Double dared him.
Keep doing it. Don't try Brenovich or any of your projects in Norfolk. No. You kept Soto around for way more money than he's worth. He's part of your debacle offseason that makes your unwatchable product even more unwatchable. Keep running him out there in the eighth inning. I dare you.
The Orioles lineup was certainly unwatchable against Mitchell Parker, who held them to just one hit. Last night...
Not even a surprise. That wasn't even a surprise, Mitchell Parker shutting them down.
Last night, Orioles had their chances. They had 12 opportunities.
The mighty Trevor Williams!
With runners in scoring position. They came through once, but Brandon Hyde had some very interesting things to say about his offense after the game, and we're going to play his comments next on The Fan.